Hello, friends. We are continuing today, maybe a couple of days later than I hoped I could resume, but nevertheless moving onward. We are working on a treatise on white magic, and it's starting video commentary number 42. This is the fifth rule, and we're on the seventh part of it, so I call it 5.7. And we are on page 180. We have been discussing the various ways that writings, spiritual writings, come through and their various degrees of reliability. And he closes the last section we dealt with by telling us to avoid mediumship, which takes the medium out of control with no mental supervision, and instead use inspiration, which he says is always safe, whereas mediumship is always to be avoided. Inspiration may involve telepathy, for the person involved may do three things. So he's dealing now with three factors related to inspiration. Okay. All right. Number one, the master or the inspiring source may use the brain of the appointed channel, throwing thoughts into it. And this is a little more direct than using the mind. Because there is always more in the mind than is in the brain, and always more in the soul than is in the mind. So it's a question of what can be accessed. But when this, when the teaching to be given is thrown into the brain, then there is immediate accessibility. He may occupy his disciple's body, the latter standing aside consciously in his subtler bodies, but surrendering his physical body. And we may recognize this in the interaction between the Christ and the initiate Jesus. And also, I propose the interaction between Prince Siddhartha and the Buddha, Gautama. So, I'm of the opinion, as I've stated before, that since the Buddha had been already by the year 600 and something BC, the head of the hierarchy for 2,000 years, he doesn't need to wander in the forest to find enlightenment as the Prince Siddhartha did, or maybe we refer to him as the Prince Gautama. But the Buddha had achieved that long before, otherwise he could not have been head of the hierarchy, and that's what I mean by inference. Now, this may be true, it may not be true. I think it is true. But taking what DK has given and putting it together, it points in a certain direction. And then we can follow that direction. That's what I mean by the teaching being presented in multiple layers. What is written is one thing, and the ways in which it can be combined to suggest other truths is also to be considered. Okay, the higher being, third method, is one of temporary fusing, if I might so call it, and I'll write that down because he makes a special point of using that word, or that phrase. And intermingling, when the user and the used alternate or supplement as needed to do the appointed work. So I cannot explain more clearly. This is interplay. Was it involved in the Christ Jesus method? Was it involved in the DKAAB method? They did have a back and forth, a kind of a conversation, we're told, wherein Alice Bailey expressed to DK, often to her surprise, I suppose, in horror, what he could not say. He intended to be so very direct. Maybe she inclined him to pull some of his punches, as he was inclined to speak in a very direct manner, which may have been, so thought Alice Bailey, shattering to the psychological state of the Western student. Also, there was a back and forth method, we are told, concerning the kind of English which was evolved in which to present the teaching. The English of the earlier books, and quite a bit in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, had a very old cast to it, more like the English of the Elizabethan period. Okay, so this is another method of telepathy, three factors relating to inspiration as the method of telepathy. Now, another one. We're learning about the legitimate and illegitimate means of conveying teaching. We're learning about what can be trusted and what cannot be trusted. We're learning about what is dangerous and what is safe. It seems that so many are very eager to have the direct word of the master and to be the channel through which the master speaks. That very desire probably precludes them from the reality, from real usefulness along this line. At first, Alice Bailey, we are told, resisted working with the Tibetan, but he asked her to give his presentation a fair hearing, and after she did, she realized the very high quality of what was coming through. She did not want to be involved in customary psychism. So, for students such as ourselves, as the Tibetan said, he's given us more than we can ever absorb, assimilate. We have plenty that has the mark of correctness on it, the proper sanction, and we have to deal with that. I think it's dangerous to go off into the amanuensis route, hoping to be the amanuensis for such a great teacher. Such amanuenses are selected by the higher source according to standards that we cannot anticipate or judge or have much knowledge about. All right, here are some other methods of getting through, of transmitting the teaching. They write what they see. This method is not of such a high order. You will note that in the first case, you have wisdom or availability on Buddhic and intuitional levels. In the second case, you have transmission from the causal body from the higher mental levels. In the third case, you have sufficient development to enable the aspirant to receive dictation. So, you know, I think in our last program, we dealt with these three cases, and you can go back and review that. But I'll just make a note here that what we have in these various cases, I could go back searching for it. I probably will for just a moment if I can possibly. okay, the true transmitters, this is what we are hearing here, they write from personal knowledge and therefore employ the concrete minds at the task of stating this knowledge. It's as if a master decides to write what he knows in a direct manner, or a high initiate. They write because they are inspired. We dealt a little bit with that. And they write because of the development of the inner hearing. We just dealt with that, and that was the method used by the Tibetan with Alice Bailey. Okay, so those were three subcategories. Now we have the telepathic communication method, registry into the brain, and we have the method of inspiration, which we just discussed. So the first three that we were looking at just now, the inner hearing, the form of inspiration, personal knowledge, that's all coming under the first category, whatever that category is. This is the first, the workers from higher egoic levels. And they have three methods of working, and we just reviewed those from personal knowledge, inspiration, and the development of the inner hearing. The second major factor is telepathic communication. Now, Alice Bailey was involved in that. And also we have inspiration. And it utilizes the mind as the medium of transmission to the brain of that which the soul knows. And, you know, as souls, as I say, we know a lot more through our experience and through maybe some triadal impression than we bring through in the mind, usually, and certainly than we focus in the brain. Okay. Now, this is the method of inspiration. Three factors related to inspiration. Okay. So the throwing of light into the brain. You know, just to review here, there's so many lists in this book. We want to be clear about them. The occupation of the disciple's body. And I wanted to say something about that, which I didn't say when we just looked at it a minute ago. That the sixth petal of the egoic lotus, okay, this is how I understand it anyway, from a reference in Cosmic Fire, I believe. The sixth SX, okay, sixth petal of the egoic lotus has to be unfolded if this method is to be possible, which means that the receiver, or the one who stands aside, must be an initiate of the second degree. And this standing aside seems to relate to Neptune, which one of the planets of the second degree, the ability to come and go from the body, and Neptune always involves the idea of an exit. It can be a rise into transcendent realms or even transcendental realms, or it can be an escape, but the idea of slipping out of the usual confinement is involved with Neptune, and that's what the disciple does when the higher teacher wants to use the body. Now, there may be a sort of a back and forth where the body is not always used, and the interval we don't know, Maybe it can last a long time. And maybe the vacating disciple looks on and learns a great deal over a long period of time. And DK told us there's going to be an unraveling of the gold and silver threads of the events and episodes in the life of Christ Jesus. We'll know what belongs to the Christ. The golden threads, we'll know what belongs to Jesus. The silver threads, and I believe that the events are the higher category, and episodes are the lower category. Now, sometimes, you know, when with his disciples, was it the Christ, was it Jesus, entered the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers. It's always seemed to me that this was an example of the work of the fiery Jesus on the sixth ray. But of course, when the Tibetan describes it, he says the only time the Christ ever entered the temple was he caused a disturbance. Now, is he being literal about that? So one day we will know what it is that what Jesus said by himself, what the Christ said through Jesus while Jesus was still in the body and being overshadowed by the presence of the Christ, and what the Christ said and did when he was taking over the body of the initiate Jesus. And another method here of this telepathic inspiration, the temporary fusing. Okay, so now that was just a little review, you know, as much for me as for you, so we can try to be clear about the various methods which may be used to influence and bring the perspectives of the higher worlds through into the physical brain consciousness. We, you know, we lost touch in the Atlantean period and in part of the Aryan period, and it became difficult to communicate with the higher worlds, and this was a kind of victory for the Black Lodge, but now that kind of reliable connection is being reestablished. So we went back and we noticed that the first case had the Buddhic and intuitional availability. The second case had transmission from the causal body, from the higher mental levels. And the third case, dictation, we've just discussed that. In the fourth case, you have the ability to see and read in the astral light, but frequently no ability to differentiate between that which is past and that which will be, and therefore you have illusion, which is often considered to be wrong interpretation and inaccuracy. As a matter of fact, let me put this in a different color just to make it a little clearer. Okay. This is a method, however, sometimes used, but unless directly used under stimulation applied by a master, it is liable to be most misleading, as is its corollary, astral clairaudience. So, astral clairvoyance and astral clairaudience can be misleading. It is the method of mental clairvoyance and requires a trained interpreting mind, which is rare indeed to find. Well, so many people are confronted with inner experiences, but what do they make of them? How do they interpret them? And if I were to, oh goodness, all right, let's see what I have to do to get our, yep, I have to get this back. And this will be the AAB diagrams. So, Let's take a look at the, here we are. We'll take a look at the level on which this is occurring in this compendium from Keith Bailey. Here is the higher clairvoyance. This is it. Mental clairvoyance on the fifth subplane of the mental plane. It's different from normal clairvoyance on the third subplane of the emotional plane. It's a higher method of reception. Okay. But still, unless used under the direct supervision of a master, can be misleading. Our problem is that we tend to think that anything subtle is true. But there are many subtle glamours. That's what they call it, the subtle body in some ways. And subtle illusions. And simply because it does not pertain to the physical plane directly in terms of the reception of the event or the object of perception, does not mean that it is true and corresponds to reality. In all the cases that I have cited, error may creep in owing to physical limitation and the handicap of words, but in the case of those who write from personal knowledge, the errors of expression will be of no real moment. Okay. He really wants us to be very careful because it's so easy to run away with the presumption that one is encountering something really true and sponsored by hierarchy when one is only encountering a subtle glamour or illusion. So in this field of cultivating the psychic powers on all the different planes, much caution, humility is needed. A willingness to be corrected, the use of the fifth ray is needed. And perhaps that's why Master Hilarion, who has so much of the fifth ray, probably in his monadic ray or submonadic ray, with a first ray monad of the major ray of the monad, is involved in helping to train psychics who need to stop and assess the veracity of that which they encounter. It's no problem to encounter these things. The question is, are they true? And do we mislead others in assuming they may be true when they're not? So we're talking about error. And this whole field of psychic development is full of the possibility of error. But if we actually know of our own experience what has unfolded before our eyes, and especially in relation to the intuition or perhaps to the higher mental plane, and we have individual personal knowledge in that regard, then such errors as may be expressed are of no real moment. In the second and third cases, the errors will be dependent upon the point of evolution of the transmitting agent. So, you know, be careful of the source which one may be aligned with, because we cannot treat all subtle sources equally. Some are just not trustworthy. However, if he couples intelligence, devotion, and service with his capacity to receive and hear, He will soon correct the errors himself, and his understanding will grow. Because he will be able to see the contradictions. He will be devoted to the truth. He will not want to convey to others any degree of falsity, and so he will examine himself in a rigorous manner. So these two things have to go together, the capacity to see and hear, okay, and all of these correct motivations. So let me put that down, that correct, correct motivations must accompany the capacity to see and hear on the subtle planes. Of course, the real world of the soul extends from the higher mental plane through the intuitional sphere and still higher. So we proceed with caution, knowing that the traps that are laid for the unwary are many, and that if we have some kind of hubris about all this and some kind of presumption that we cannot be incorrect, it opens up a dangerous situation where we may be fooled or we may fool ourselves. Later, two new methods will be employed which will facilitate the transmission of truth from the inner side to the outer plane. This is interesting. Is he going to tell us what they will be? Precipitated writing. Now, this is something that Master K.H. and Master Moria both used. We are told by Blavatsky that letters would appear written in red by Moria and blue by K.H. Of course, we have to think about what letters they were, because Master D.K. told us that, let's say, the Mahatma letters are our subject, that not so many of those letters were authentic, but were the work of HPB. But maybe there were some authentic ones, probably. And apparently the red writing and the blue writing were characteristic of the two masters that were trying to communicate. Precipitated writing will be given to those who can be trusted, but the time is not yet for its general use. Okay. So much patience is required in this gradualism of esoteric training. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. This is what the rules of the road tell us. Haste does make waste, and we have to disentangle ourselves from our errant efforts. So the true occultist is not only wise, but cautious. And caution, of course, is in a way a part of wisdom. And we know the old saying that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. I sometimes think it's kind of a mantra for, or a descriptor for the Aries life. So I've always been watchful of that tendency. Well, maybe not always. Maybe school of hard knocks has taught one to be watchful. Okay. It will be necessary to wait until the work of the esoteric schools has reached a more definite phase of development. Now, as you know, that's what we're working on in the Moria Federation. Well, named after the great teacher because he is the head of all esoteric schools and organizations, and the schools will be federated. There's no presumption at this. I mean, you know, there's no federation yet. There is the promise of a coming federation and the realization that Master Moria is the head of all esoteric schools. So one calls it that in the hope that the ideal will be realized and that the participants, both teachers and students, will attempt to live up to those high possibilities. So it will be necessary to wait until the work of the esoteric schools has reached a more definite phase of development. And at one point in Raves and Initiations, he tells us that the kinds of schools that he described in Letters on Occult Meditation do lie far ahead from some of the things he said in LOM, Letters on Occult Meditation. You begin to think that work is already being done and that planning is already underway and that the seeds of these schools are, some of them, already planted. And that may be true, but the full flowering of these schools or even definiteness of development does lie far ahead. Conditions as yet are not appropriate, but humanity is urged to be ready and open-minded and prepared for this development. Who knows, maybe, I tend to think, maybe once we are really clear of the sixth ray, Piscean influence by the end of the present century. I think DK told us more or less, and that's when we would be free, and especially of the Piscean influence, and when it comes to the sixth ray influence, certainly by 2125, I would guess. And the age of Aquarius beginning in 2117, according to that letter that we have from DK to Roberto Assagioli. Later will come the power to materialize thought forms. Well, that's going to be one that only the very trusted can handle. One wonders even if the masters are using that to any extent right now. So let's say precipitated writing will be given to those who can be trusted. So from the higher source and directly will come the writing that tells the truth and is not subject to the kind of distortion that the medium of reception may impose upon the original message. And then the power to materialize thought forms. This would be a terrible piece of information to be released at this time, given the quality of the thought forms that characterize many advanced but immoral thinkers. People will come into incarnation who will have the ability temporarily to create and vitalize these thought forms, and so enable the general public to see them. And, will the master be advising on these matters? Probably. But already, the people involved in this process are, will be pre-trained in other lives and have a relevant abilities. The time, however, is not yet. Okay, there is too much fear and not enough experience of truth in the world. And it's so amazing, I don't know when you're going to be listening to this. This is the year 2018 in the very beginning of it, February. There's such falsity coming through those who have the ear of the public, so much lying, so much distortion, deliberate. There are alternative facts now being presented. It defies rational thought how people can buy into that, and yet the people of some countries, maybe we can say the United States at this time, which is heir to the Piscean civilization, the consciousness of many people is not trained to discriminate truth from falsity, and so they can become the what can I call it, the willing responders to any powerful demagogue. their astral body responds and they cannot think clearly. So there's too much fear and not enough experience of truth in the world. And we're going to have to reestablish trustworthiness in public life. So trustworthiness in public life must be reestablished. Has it ever existed, really? Well, probably not entirely. You know, that somewhat humorous question that how do you know when a politician is lying? Well, his lips are moving. Anyway, and the different professions can be slotted into that. So we have a lot of corrective work to do so that the public discourse is on a higher level and it will not be considered proper or acceptable to lie to the public. Right now, if you can manipulate the public, so some people think, anything goes, and you can try anything you want. And the way that master propagandist and individual strongly influenced by the Black Lodge used to say, if you're going to tell a lie, tell it big. So we have much correction. More knowledge must be acquired as to the nature of thought and of matter. So this is the magical process, right? The details of the magical process, which is not necessarily good or bad. And this must be followed experimentally by those with acute trained minds, a high rate of vibration, and bodies built of the finest matter. Well, he tells us that the seventh ray is going to help with the building of the bodies and the raising of the rate of vibration anyway. And it is a ray of, it's a synthetic ray. The seventh ray is synthetic and can be used in relation to all these three requirements. The attainment of this will involve discipline, pain, self-abnegation, and abstinence. And I love the way he says, see you to it. Every once in a while, Master DK is very, very direct. And this is one of those moments. I just have to see, you know, it strikes me not as funny, but as somewhat amusing, you know, that people think that these abilities will come easily. So, you know, discipline we can probably tolerate because we're going to be drawing upon Saturn, especially during the first part of the Age of Aquarius, the first decanate. Pain? Okay, well, it sounds like the laws of karma are at work, and Saturn is certainly involved with that, and self-abnegation, it's not exalting one's lower ego or personality, is it? And abstinence is Saturn again. Well, you know, so I just have to say, you know, these Saturnian requirements. And the use of that planet as the planet of opportunity, giving us opportunity to do what is really useful and helpful in our discipleship. The use of that planet must be a conscious effort. He's our friend, even though denying many of the desires of the personality. Just think of the contrast between Saturn and Mars. Mars is involved as the ruler of every level of the personality, maybe except the etheric body, certainly the physical body, the emotional body, the lower mental body, and the personality as a whole. And Saturn comes along and says, no. We do it a different way. We do it in the way that is more aligned with the divine plan. So if you are a disciple and you're expecting that the Age of Aquarius will be a piece of cake, you know, as the song tends to offer. Harmony, love, ease, all the rest. It won't be, this will be a period of intensive training and of difficulty. He says the first decanate of Aquarius, 720 years, I guess, roughly that, will be a period of difficulty. So we have to be prepared for that difficulty for what? Well, difficulty for the personality as it seeks to express in the usual way. That will not be allowed for the true disciple, and the true disciple will undertake the necessary discipline to make his or her vehicles fit to receive and transmit the energies of the higher worlds. The group of teachers with whom the average aspirants and probationary disciples may be in touch on the mental plane are but men of like passions, but with a longer experience upon the path and a wiser control of themselves. Now, is he saying, are these masters or initiates of some standing? Because when he says men of like passions, it seems to eliminate the masters who have passed through the Martian phase of passion. And the Martian phase in which the personality is emphasized. I'm just amazed at how much the planet Mars is associated with just about every expression of the personality, I say, except for the etheric body, where Vulcan, I think, has a stronger rulership, and also Gemini and Aquarius and Uranus. Maybe not so much Mars. Now he says, average aspirants. There is, I suppose, a group of teachers for those who are not average aspirants and probationary disciples. So we're talking about who the average aspirant or probationer works with more highly developed men, maybe not masters yet. Let's see what he says. They do not work with aspirants because they, average aspirants and probationary disciples. Here he says they do, and then he says they don't. They do not work with aspirants. Oh, here it is. They do not work with aspirants because they personally like or care for them, but because the need is great and they seek those they can train. So we don't take personally the attention of the master, and when we run into that phase of discipleship that we call the chela in the master's heart, it's not some kind of sentimental loving relationship. It's a technical occult phase of probably one who is very close to or taking or slightly beyond the fourth initiation. The blending of the lights goes farther. The attitude of mind that they look for is that of teachableness and the ability to record and refrain from questioning until more is known. And, you know, as Morya once said, the manus of many individuals will fight you, you know, will fight you. So let not the teaching be overly resisted. You know, question intelligently, okay, and judgment reserved until more is known. Then, when more is known, the aspirant is urged to question everything, and what that does is it works against blind faith, which can lead the sincere but not too intelligent aspirant astray and again waste much time. May I remind you of the words of one teacher who said, quote, "Know us for sane and balanced men who teach as we taught on earth, not flattering our pupils, but disciplining them. We lead them on not forcing them forward by feeding their ambitions by promises of power, but giving them information and leading them to use it in their work, knowing that right use of knowledge leads to experience and achievement of the goal. Now, who said that? You know, every time I think, you know, the relationship of Master DK with Master Kutumi is such that sometimes when he refers to a teacher or a sage, he may be talking about Master Kutumi as when he talked about a sage teaching him, i.e. DK, how to esoterically bisect the square. Sounds very geometrical, and it sounds like something that the sage Pythagoras would have known and imparted to his closest student. How often does one find a student more occupied with the master and what he will do than he is with his own side of the question? I think DK is suggesting, you know, very often, because it's quite glamorous and exalting and flattering and interesting to think about the master and how the master is relating to him and what the master will do for him, than concentrating on one's own requirements to make oneself usefully worthy of the master's attention, the master's impersonal attention, which considers us as energy units, useful or maybe not so useful in the manifestation of the divine plan related to the ashram of that master. And yet the fitting of himself for service and the equipping of himself for useful cooperation is or should be his main preoccupation. You know, we just can't ever think, well, now I've arrived and now I'm fit, you know. For the person who thinks of himself or herself as finally fit, there is always more to be done to improve. So the attitude, you know, just as revelation is ongoing, but some people would like to cut it short and say this religion has the final revelation, a very dangerous thing. So there's always more refinement ahead possible. Otherwise, there would be no progression in the various initiations that are offered and are possible. Inquiry about the master is more interesting than inquiry about the needed qualifications for discipleship. You know, there's lots of hard work to be done here. And sometimes we fall into the glamorous pattern of thinking entirely about the master in some very bizarre, exalted, glamorous manner. You know, I'm not sure how many Hail Master this and Hail Master that are needed to convince the master that maybe he has an intelligent disciple through whom he can work. But such is the human tendency, and such is the prevailing glamorous distortion on the astral plane, driving us into patterns which are not really of interest or use to the master who is intent upon the expression of the divine plan. Interest for the data available in relation to the adepts is more potent than the steadfast investigation into limitations and disabilities which should engross the master's attention. There's such, you know, I love this book, loving it more all the time because of the straight talk which we have. This is really a manual for the up-and-coming disciple, or at least for the probationary aspirant to become the true disciple, and maybe for the true disciple to become the initiate. Curiosity as to the habits and methods of specific masters and their way of handling their disciples is more prone to be displayed than patient application and to right habits and ways of work in the life of the would-be disciple. It's, so it's just, these are humbling words, and For anybody that hopes to be endlessly excited about their spiritual occult life, there's lots of grunt work in the spiritual sense needed to be done. All these matters are side issues and only handicap and limit, and one of the first things we advise one who would enter into communication with the Masters is to take his eyes off those things which concern him not, focus his attention on the needed steps and stages which should demonstrate in his life, and eliminate those wasted moments, moods, and thought periods which so often occupy the major part of his thought life. Well, that's not very flattering, is it? And the Master is not likely to be flattering. The Master is likely to say a few things in an arresting and potent manner, and then with the implication, as we've had up here a few paragraphs ago, see you to it, see you to it. So, you know, Alice Bailey was interestingly fond of telling us to mind our own business at the level that we find ourselves, and don't be excessively interested in things that don't concern us and will not really advance us on the path. We have to make good in our probationary life and our discipleship life, and eventually in our initiatic life. And I love this, that the major part of our thought life, goodness, it doesn't, it's not an assessment which points to the correct consecration of the thought life to what is truly spiritually profitable. When a master seeks to find those fitted to be instructed and taught by him, he looks for three things, first of all. Unless these are present, no amount of devotion and aspiration, and no purity of life and mode of living suffices. Now, these are the hard facts of the situation. You know, we can be very, very good, very, very devoted, very, very aspirational, but we might just be missing certain fundamental requirements which have to be built in. It is essential that all aspirants should grasp these three factors and so save themselves much distress of mind and wasted motion. The master looks for the light in the head, whether or not the disciple sees it, because the seeing of it depends upon the phenomenal condition of the brain cells. It might be there, and the connection with the intuition might be there, and the disciple will never know it. The master investigates the karma of the aspirant, and he notes his service in the world. Well, these are three big factors which are foundational to usefulness to the master as he attempts through his ashram to manifest that portion of the divine plan which is assigned to his ashram or undertaken by his ashram. Unless there is indication that the man is what is termed esoterically a lighted lamp, it is useless for the master to waste his time. So basically, the ability of the mind to be held steady in the light, and for this mental light conveying soul light to be transferred to the brain, is not much use. The soul, mind, brain, alignment must at least be potential or in process or achieved to some degree. So the light in the head, which would mean that brain radiance is involved, when present is indicative of what? Three things, and that, you know, probably I won't be able to do much more than this right now. The functioning to a greater or lesser extent of the pineal gland, which is, as is well known, as Descartes knew, the seat of the soul and the organ of spiritual perception. It's kind of a Taurus organ in some way having to do with illumination. It is in this gland that the first physiological changes take place incident upon soul contact, and this contact is brought about through definite work along meditation lines, mind control, and the inflow of spiritual force. So what do we have here? You know, the need for pineal stimulation. And incidentally, you know, the etheric correspondences to those in the etheric brain. Then the aligning, B, the aligning of the man on the physical plane with his ego, soul, or higher self. On the mental plane, and the subordination of the physical plane life and nature to the impress and control of the soul. So this is an effective soul, mind, brain alignment. And we have to, you know, do this on the physical plane with respect to our brain. So this is covered sufficiently in the first two or three chapters of Letters on Occult Meditation, and these should be studied by the aspirant. And I do hope that I will have the opportunity to do a video commentary on that wonderful little book, which is far deeper and more difficult than many people might imagine. And then point C, the downflow of force via the Sutratma magnetic cord or thread from the soul to the brain via the mind body. So there are, you know, higher energies to higher energies must flow, and you know, it's not really downward, but we'll call it that. So the downflow is what we're talking about. DOWNFLOW. The whole secret of spiritual vision, correct perception, and right contact lies in the proper appreciation of the above statement. And therefore, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are ever the textbook of disciples, initiates, and adepts even. For therein are found those rules and methods which bring the mind under control, stabilize the astral body, and so develop and strengthen the thread soul that it can and does become a veritable channel of communication between the man and his ego. I think he's looking, thread soul is considered here in the general sense, and not just as the conveyor of vitality. The light of illumination streams down into the brain cavity, the cave, we might call it, as some groups call it, and throws into objectivity three fields of knowledge. This is often forgotten, and hence the undue distress and premature interpretations of the partially illumined disciple or probationer. Okay, well, that will be, we'll review that just a little bit, but this will be the end of a treatise on white magic rule 5.7, page whatever. I always get lost here, and this is no exception. Page up to 184, and beginning where, going backward. There we are. Page 180 to 184. Well, it's just about four. At the present rate that I'm traveling, about four pages per program. And it's just the beginning, as you know. And as I've said, we cannot imagine that one listen and one pass to what I'm trying to say here, one study session will do the job. Okay, and this is the beginning of a treatise on white magic, a video commentary, and I'll put that video commentary in here as well. And we're beginning rule 5.8 and page 184 to wherever it takes us. All right, friends. Marvelous little book. Marvelous, not a little book. Not a little book, really. It's a big book. And it's a treasure, as are, you know, all the writings of Master DK. And, of course, Alice Bailey did a marvelous job, too, as she said, writing my own book so I could show that I, after all, had a brain. Something like that. I think a little humor going on there. But she did a good job with that, and you can certainly tell the difference. I mean, she had that Ray One mind, and DK's approach is different. But anyway, we are much enriched by what we have received from these great communicators. So that'll be it for the moment. I forgot something, didn't I? This is going to be number 43. Goodness, how could I forget that, huh? And this is the end of video commentary number 42. All right, we'll see you when I can next resume. I'd like to do these things the whole day long, but Saturn and karma say otherwise. Okay, bye-bye.